Welcome to the Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast brought to you by DragonMount.com.
The Wheel of Time is an epic fantasy series created by Robert Jordan.
At its conclusion, the series will consist of 14 novels and one prequel novel.
Sadly, Robert Jordan did not live to see his work complete.
Brandon Sanderson, appointed by Mr. Jordan's widow, Harriet Rigney, will complete the series with the novels The Gathering Storm, Towers of Midnight, and A Memory of Light, based on the notes left by Mr. Jordan.
This podcast is dedicated to discussing and enjoying the monumental work of fiction that is The Wheel of Time. Welcome, everyone, to episode 60 of The Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast, brought to you by DragonMount.com. I, of course, am Andrew Gellos, and this week it's a boys' night out, so joining me this week will be Spencer.
Hey, everyone. Yeah, Virginia, for the first time in a long time, is not going to be able to be with us.
Yes, and though we know she would love to be here to discuss everything with us, it's kind of appropriate because the chapters we will be covering in our continuing recap of Knife of Dreams this week will be a large contingent of Matt chapters.
And as always on the Fourth Age, we want to make sure that you all know that we are going to be discussing all the books in the Wheel of Time series. So if you haven't read them all, you might want to put off listening to the podcast until you have, or you'll probably find out things that you didn't want to know yet.
This particular set of chapters is going to begin with Chapter 7, A Cold Medallion, picks up exactly where Chapter 6 leaves off. With news of the Shanshan soldiers near the circus, Matt sends Nol to warn Aegyanin and Alvar to warn the Aes Sedai and Sul'dahm. Aegyanin, of course, is now only answering to the name Lyalwyn Shipless. He leaves Tuan and Seleucia in their wagon, though he thinks about setting Harnan to guard them. Outside, several hundred Shanshan soldiers have arrived at Jurador. There are native Shanshan, as well as Taraviners and Amadisians. Three of them try to enter the circus without paying, but a horse handler named Bolin won't let them in. Luca, Petra, and other circus men nearby come over to help shore up the lines and prevent people from coming in without paying. A Shanshan officer comes up and chastises the leader of the three and sends them back towards the encampment. The officer then attempts to recruit from the circus folk and even asks Matt if he'd like to join the Imperial Army. Matt goes off to join the Aes Sedai. Blerick and Fenn are not at the wagon. As he approaches, Matt feels his foxhead medallion going cold, and he knows someone is channeling. This, of course, makes him extremely angry, and he bangs the door open. Jolene, Teslin, Edesina, Bethamon, Seta, and Satel Anon are all there. Jolene is slapping Bethamon. Matt, of course, stops her, and she slaps him. Matt can't accept that, so he does the only thing that is sure to humiliate anyone, but especially an Aes Sedai. He turns her over his knee and gives her a sound paddling. The other Aes Sedai try to stop him, and they're shocked when Matt's foxhead blocks their channeling. Satel asks if she can see the Tarangriel that he has to have. She thinks that Kutswane had one like it once. She knows about the test for the shawl as well. Blerick and Fenn arrive, but Jolene slams the door in their faces. Matt gets the story. Jolene apparently had wanted to see the Shanshan. Bethamon and Seta had tried to stop her. Edesina bound them with air. Bethamon channeled a shower of sparks on them. Because Bethamon has channeled, she now has to be trained, or she runs a high risk of dying due to not understanding how to control the power. While they argue about it, Matt decides it's fair time that he should leave. He thinks, at least now, he doesn't have to worry about what happened to the Adam anymore. That evening, he wins 2 games of stones against Tuan, and goes to sleep in the wagon he shares with Aegyanin and Domin, with the dice, of course, still rattling in his head.
The first thing to point out here is that the menagerie really isn't defenseless. I mean, you kind of think about all these show folk, and they're going around and setting up a tent outside towns and performing for the people, you kind of think, well, they're an easy target or whatever, and obviously people do. These soldiers appear to think that. But they have their own kind of defenses, if nothing more than strength in numbers, and they show it out here very well. When the soldiers are trying to take advantage of them, they just show up and say, no, you don't.
Yeah, definitely. Also, it was one of those things, I kind of every now and then get images in my head of what people are sort of like, and I am continually impressed with Valen Luka. I mean, in here, you know, it's not just that he's like, oh, there are people trying to get in. Quick, go stop them. You know, no, he steps right up there with them and, you know, is, you know, front lines saying, you know, this is my establishment. You're not coming in here if you don't pay. And I just, once again, he is one of those glue characters in my mind. And, you know, the more chances you get to see him, the more there's that chance that you're just going to turn up a little something unexpected with him that really seems to bring a little more life to the entire situation, the entire show.
Yeah, and it's just amazing what RJ has done, because you even have these secondary characters like Luka, and they are layered like an onion. They have so many different personalities and traits, and you can just keep digging and digging and digging and find new stuff each and every time. It's not an act. He genuinely does like to be the center of attention, and he is kind of this puffed up and just Valen Luka, the owner of this traveling show. But in spite of that, he's still courageous at times. We see him later in chapters. He's able to connect with the people on a very fundamental level, but it's absolutely amazing just what you can find out about any and every character as soon as you start digging.
Yeah, I honestly think that amongst the many minor characters that it would be fun to play in a Wheel of Time movie or TV series, Luka is another one of those ones that I just think would be really, really fun to play. It seems like he would be one of those really nice characters that, you know, you show up every few episodes or, you know, once or twice in the movies and, you know, it'd just be a really fun kind of, you know, on with the show kind of, you know, character to play that just, you know, people are like, oh, hey, I remember him from that.
Yeah, definitely. Moving on, is it actually possible for Jolene to be this arrogant? She knows what the Shanshin can do. She knows what the Shanshin do. And she spent several weeks hiding in a basement so that she wouldn't get caught and collared. And the first chance she gets, she wants to go stare at them.
Yeah, I don't know. She it really just intrigues me at how mule-headed the Aes Sedai can get. And it's really weird, just the idea that, you know, what happens when, you know, Bethamon, you know, channels the sparks, you know? What does Jolene do? I mean, there's so many different things in that. She walks up and she starts slapping her. I mean, come on, seriously? You're an Aes Sedai, you've been Aes Sedai for how long, you're how old, and you're slapping someone over, you know, this random and, you know, at this point, you know, almost miraculous event, because, you know, getting any Shanshin to actively channel at all just is, you know, astounding.
Yeah, it's interesting, the argument they get into, because you have, on one side, the Jolene and Edesina and even Setala and Nan are all saying, okay, now we need to teach her to channel. It's our duty to teach her so that she doesn't kill herself. But on the other side, you've got Bethamon and Sita and Teslin, which doesn't surprise me, her, but they're all arguing for just let her die.
Yeah, and I mean, part of that just stems out of, you know, the Shanshin subculture, where at this point, it's to Bethamon, it would be as if she caught, like, a rather virulent and fatal disease. I find it interesting that they are so caught up in this idea of, we've now found this new source of people who can channel, and if they can be taught properly, that could effectively be used as a weapon against their entire way of life. That it's that weird tenuous balance, and I'm sure the Aes Sedai have their own rationalizations for how they see things, but honestly, from Bethamon's point of view, it's like, you know, I've begun to channel, they're going to find me, they're going to collar me, I can't let that happen, just let me die already. And it's just this probably primal terror on their part, or on Bethamon and Seda's part.
Yeah, and you know that Seda is afraid of Bethamon now, and I think she's equally afraid of herself and the ability that she knows that she has. Because like you said, that's part of their culture. Women who can channel are dangerous. They need to be collared like any other beast, like a rabid dog or something. It's really interesting to me, Tessalyn's reaction to it. Because even as abused as she has been by them, I really don't think that's enough to merit the wanting of someone to die. Because that can't be a nice way to die. That's got to be incredibly painful, long, and drawn out. Or I wouldn't have pegged her as cruel that way.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it kind of makes me, in a way, think back to Egwene and her prejudice against the Seanchan for having been collared and the way she was treated. Because, you know, it reminds me of when Elaine and Nynaeve are telling her about their own interactions with the Seanchan, and you can kind of see that same sort of mindset where something in them is hardened beyond what you would think is possible. And, you know, I personally am thinking, in Egwene's case, that's leading up to the confrontation in Gathering Storm and in the final two the final two volumes, wherein something's going to have to happen, because we know from the dreams that at some point a Seanchan may be responsible for saving Egwene's life.
Yeah, it's going to be really hard for both of them, and really any sister who is collared and then actually gets released, because we know there's been sisters who's been collared and broken. But any sister who's been collared and then accepts being released, it's going to be really hard for them to get over that.
Yeah, I mean, it, in a way, you have the two variations. You have the people who are captured and they end up undergoing Stockholm syndrome, like most Damane, where when the collar is released, they immediately run back, and, you know, because they have to, you know, they become so ingrained in it that, yeah, they're just broken to the point that they identify too much with their captors. And then you have the extreme opposite, in which it develops into this, you know, nearly, in extreme cases, sociopathic need to avenge yourself upon your captor, you know, in every opportunity that you are able to take advantage of.
Yeah, and I think I was paying too much attention to Tessalyn when I read through here, though, because I have a note. When Matt is finally spanking Jolene, because she's been asking for it for a long time. And Mistress Anan is coming to kind of put herself between them. She's pushing between the two other Aes Sedai. And Tessalyn made a peremptory gesture for her to remain where she was. And to me, it's kind of interesting. I don't see why she would want to stop Mistress Anan from going and stopping Matt. That there's really, as far as I can see it, there's only two possibilities. Either she didn't feel that Mistress Anan should be interfering with Aes Sedai business, or, my personal favorite, is she wants to give Matt more time to administer this discipline because she knows that Jolene deserves it oh so much.
My first inclination is probably that it has a lot to do with Aes Sedai business. Just the idea that obviously, people tried to stop Matt using the One Power, and then, you know, were shocked when it failed. Seems to suggest that, you know, they don't accept that Satel has the right to intervene, even if she would be more capable of persuading Matt to stop than they themselves could be. But at the same time, yeah, Jolene has totally been asking for it for quite a while, and I could very well see it being one of those little petty Aes Sedai rivalry type things where it's like, no, you know, no, let us enjoy this a little bit. One of the other things that I really liked about this chapter, again, is Satel asking about the Tarangril that she assumes Matt has to have. It's interesting that she knows at all about Kutsuane's Tarangril, because we know that a number of the Angreal, or the Tarangril that she wears, haven't been identified, at least in the books yet. And we're not certain that they function exactly the same way as Matt's fox head, but we brought up in previous podcasts that there is certainly a similarity in the way that some of Kutsuane's Tarangreal do seem to disrupt the weavings of other people. But it's also one of those nice moments where you get those wonderful little clues and everything to Satel's past, you know, that eventually will lead us to a wonderful, wonderful discovery about who Satel was and how she can know as much as she does about everything involving Aes Sedai.
Yeah. We know that Nynaeve has a Tarangreal that does the same thing, because when she loaned out her armament to Aleva in Winter's Heart during the cleansing of Sidene, and Lanfear threw a fireball at her, it just absolutely melted away. Now, I don't know if that means it works the same as Matt's medallion, because things I've seen of Matt's medallion, it doesn't seem like it would stop a fireball, because after it's been thrown, it's no longer a weave, but it does seem to accomplish a lot of the same things.
Yeah, I mean, when I originally read that scene with Aleva in Winter's Heart, I think I had originally assumed that the armor, or the rings and bracelets Tarangreal allowed her to sense the weave coming, and that she had unraveled it herself. But the more I have read since then, the more I am kind of convinced that this is a holdover from the War of Power itself, when, you know, the Aes Sedai needed every advantage, and of course they're going to create Tarangreal that are going to, you know, counteract the weavings of other channelers. So I could very well see that it might be something similar. I think Matt's, and this goes back to my own little pet theory, that Matt's Tarangreal is very specific and was crafted specifically for him by the Finns to do what it does. But I on that account, we will have to, you know, read and find out, just because otherwise we have no idea or no way of proving for a fact whether or not they were that specific with their gifts, if they can be called that.
Well, I'm going to have to dispute that point with you real quick, because everything that I've heard indicates that the Finn don't have that kind of power. I'm not sure that they would have the power to create a Tarangreal.
Like I said, for me, it is, we haven't seen enough evidence, but something in my mind links the Finns to the creation of the Shadow Spawn, which was why questions concerning the Shadow are dangerous to them, or for people asking the questions. And that I just, for some reason, because of the Tarangreal itself and the power wrought blade that Matt now carries in the Ashandari, it just seems to me like it would be far, far too convenient for those things to have just been lying around in Rhydian, for the Finns to have just gone, oh, this looks appropriate for him, and this looks appropriate for him, here you go. So I kind of developed this little theory that the Finns are actually the ones who initially enable humans to recognize what channeling is and begin instructing humans on how to do that. Like I said, I very well could be wrong, because this falls under crazy theory territory, but that was partially along the lines of my thinking, is that, you know, a lot of those designs might have been handed down from the Finns at one point or another.
Yeah. And it's kind of obvious that the Finn have, dare I say it, a magic all their own that doesn't have much of anything to do with the One Power. Because unless the Tower of Genji, or however you want to pronounce that, is some major form of Terangreal, there doesn't seem to be any reason why drawing a symbol with a bronze blade would have any effect on it. Unless there's some other force at work that isn't the One Power.
Yeah, definitely. Well, it also kind of goes back to that idea that we know the Finns are holding Moraine. We know that the Finns were capable of holding Lanfear. So how are they doing that? I mean, you can't leave. You know, if they are not in some way connected to the power, then what do they use that they are able to overpower and hold one of the most powerful channelers we have known to exist?
Yeah. And I have my own pet theory about that, but I'm not going to bring it up here because we could do a whole episode on the Finns and still have more to talk about. Plus, we'll talk about them in the later chapter.
This is very true.
Chapter 8 is entitled Dragon's Eggs. And it's, of course, still from Matt's point of view. After the confrontation with the Shanshan soldiers, Luca and the circus break camp to leave Jurador before dawn the next morning. Petra and Clarine hitch up their wagon. Matt rousts the Red Arms in order to hitch up the teams to Tuon's wagon and saddle Pips. Gordon drives the wagon with Tuon and Seleucia at either side. Matt rides beside the Aes Sedai wagon. He fills the Fox and Medallion Ghoul cool, so they are channeling, but it doesn't go cold, so he doesn't think that it's too much to continue. At midday, they arrive at the town of Runen Crossing. Luca negotiates with the mayor and the Wisdom, who they call Mother Darvel, for the price and the terms and conditions for them to set up their show. That night, Matt talks with Aldra. He figured out why she needs a Balefounder, which is to make bronze lofting tubes for fireworks. She wants a weapon to repay the Shanshan for destroying the Illuminators Guild. She will call the tubes dragons and the charges dragon's eggs. In other words, she's creating cannons and exploding cannonballs. Matt says he knows someone who can get them made. He sees the swirling colors and Ram talking with Loyal. It is a secret that only Tom and Julian, Iganon and Domon and Teslin and Jolene and Vannin and the Red Arms know. The someone he knows is the Dragon Reborn. Aldra agrees to go with Matt when he leaves the circus, and one set of dice stops rattling, although he doesn't really recognize it at the time. That night, Matt dreams of men dying in hundreds of battles and the Dark One laughing. The next morning, Iganon and Domon go into the village and have Mother Darvel marry them. Matt leaves them the wagon and buys a tent from the Sword Swallower twins. They're part of the show. Lopin and Nerin try to outdo each other serving Matt, though they miss their previous employers. He has guests over, and Noel is telling stories. Ulver is playing snakes and foxes. Tom and Julian are out scouting for news. Amatheria is still terrified of all the Shanshan. Matt sees images of Rand, often with Min, and he spends a lot of time with Tuon. She asks him about the Dragon Reborn at one point. The prophecies are clear that he must kneel to the Crystal Throne before Tarmogaidon. She wonders if he, being Rand, was the one who sounded the Horn of Valir at Falme. Matt is badly shaken, and he loses the round of stones that they're playing.
4 days out of Jurador, Matt gives Tuon the razor. Another set of dice stops. Matt has Pips already saddled, and Metwin brings Seleucia's Dapple so they can go for a ride. They pass a tinker caravan, and suddenly Tuon gallops off the road into the trees. Matt and Seleucia follow. Tuon names the razor Akeen, which means swallow in the old tongue. This is after Matt's caught her and they stop running. They are among some ruins, which Matt, from his extra
memories, recognizes. The hills around them are called the Dancers, and the ruins where they are was called Londaren Kor, which is the capital city of Erron. He also remembers dying in a battle near the hills, and he wonders how the Elfin collected the memories from the dead man. Matt thinks they must create a link, so they must still be in his head, too. So Lucia catches up and says the Tinkers are following. Matt talks with the Seeker while Tuon and Seleucia talk with the women. The Tinkers are heading toward Ibudar because they have heard that the Shanchan offer safety. Tinkers take their women who can channel straight to Tar-Valon. After appeasing the Tinkers, because Tuon and Seleucia said something that made all the women laugh, Matt and the two ladies go back to the circus.
You know, one of the interesting things in this chapter is the recognizing that there are multiple sets of dice rattling in Matt's head. At first, we know that Matt thinks that it's just particularly bad and that the dice are, you know, louder than usual. And he notices that things change when the dice stop for Aludra and when they stop. As they continue, you know, to stop, he notices a difference, and it's interesting because it's that kind of continuous, so many things are linked and necessary and pivotal based on his decisions, that it's really neat to see that there's a layering effect that Matt, if he is wise about it, can take advantage of.
Yeah, and it's really interesting because he says that every time that the dice have stopped, he doesn't always know why they've stopped. There's been times that they've stopped, especially in the presence of Tuon, that they've stopped many times that he has no idea why or what's happened or how it all works. This time we know it's because he made a really good choice with the horse, as Eganon, or whatever she wants to call herself, points out later. But I think it'd be really interesting to have dice rattling inside one's head. I can't imagine what that would feel like.
Yeah, as far as the dice go, I have this weird image in my mind. You know, number one of, you know, my spidey sense is tingling, but at the same time, I also get that concept that some people will spoof on, where in the horror movies, where, you know, with the evil person is sneaking up to kill the unsuspecting teenagers, that, you know, there's always that, you know, dude, or something, some music ominously going on in the back of the head. And in some ways, I kind of see the dice being like that. It's like rumble, 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 rumble. And you're like, oh, okay, that can't be good at all.
Well, to get us back on topic, I love this. We hear it over and over and over again throughout all of the series, is Matt Bloody Coffin was no bloody hero. And it's just, we hear this far too often for it to be anything except a foreshadowing. And we know that Matt has actually completed some rather heroic deeds in his time, but he still keeps saying it. So it makes me wonder what we still have to see from Matt. Is there any way for him to get any cooler besides going to Shanchan in the middle of winter?
I don't know. I mean, I of course, you know, having read through Knife of Dreams, I am tempted to say, yes, he can get cooler. But beyond Knife of Dreams, I don't know. It's going to be hard to top. I don't know necessarily. It seems like Matt Bloody Coffin is no bloody hero means, you know, he doesn't really think of himself as being heroic. You know, he does what needs to be done. He does the best he can to keep the people around him safe. But he doesn't necessarily think that's heroism as it's told, like, in the stories or something. Which, of course, you know, he's blatantly wrong in almost every case. He does things that other people can't or won't do and goes to extremes to make certain that the right things happen in the right way. And I mean, he might not always be in control of it, but I mean, he is very central to it. And it's an interesting kind of dichotomy that he has that measure of humility, particularly because of the three boys, Matt is the least humble. He is the most brazen and out there, but in the same way, he's got this really strange and nice kind of reserved humility, which is nice to see in the character.
Well, I love how it's not really humble humility. It's, Matt Bloody Coffin was no bloody hero. I don't want to do this. This isn't something I want to have to put up with. This isn't something I want to be. It's too difficult, and I don't want to have to do anything that's difficult.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Matt totally whines all the time about it. And, you know, I firmly see that Matt in the series is one of the great complainers. But I think just from, you know, actions throughout the series and actions later in the book, on some level, he does enjoy it. Or on some level, he does understand how pivotal he really is. One of his final statements in one of the last battles in the book is just absolutely wonderful, and we'll of course get to that later within the series.
Yeah, and I have to ask, but I'm not sure that anyone here can answer, what in the world made Tuon go galloping off? Was it just because she enjoys making trouble for Matt? Or to see how he would react, or... I don't know. Who can understand women, I guess? I don't know.
I think it was partially a test to see how Matt would react. I think part of it was a test to see what she could do with the horse. Because, you know, she makes a comment about the horse, and Matt makes his little statement of, you know, I have a good eye, precious, you know, which is continuing their little game. And I think, you know, part of her really did just want to test the horse and to try to, you know, she has to, even knowing her fate, and probably especially knowing that she's going to marry Matt, has to, she has to feel confined. And just that wild abandon of just taking off and galloping and dashing on such an amazingly wonderful horse has to be an exhilarating and rather liberating experience. So, I mean, I think there's a multitude of reasons behind it. And, you know, maybe not the most sound of judgment with, you know, people all over the place that could discover you at any moment. But, you know, it also leads us to another one of those wonderful moments where Matt gets intruded upon by the ghosts of other people's pasts.
Yeah. And it's also interesting, it kind of, backtracking a bit, in the last chapter, when Matt's going to leave Tuon because of, going to check up on people because of the Shanchen that are across the road from the circus, Tuon asks him as he's leaving, no warnings for us to remain inside, no one left to guard us. And I think what Matt says here is absolutely phenomenal. He just, you gave your word, and he trusts that she'll keep her word. And then in this one, even when she takes off, he says he wished he knew what she was up to, not escape, he was sure. He is so absolutely sure of this lady, and sure of her word and the way she'll act and the way she'll be, that he's not afraid, that even when she's galloping like a crazy woman through the trees, he's not afraid that she's trying to escape. Because he's sure that she won't.
It was another one of those weird moments where Matt's kind of wondering about the Finns and his connection to them. Yeah, I found it interesting because during his little flashback to dying, and that it brings in the entire issue of his connection to the Finns. You know, he finds it interesting that, you know, only chunks. It's not like he gets the collected memories of all these different men. You know, what were the odds that if, you know, they had just stuffed him with random bits and pieces? You know, likely things they had considered rubbish or had done away with. And it kind of leads to wonder, what did they do with the memories anyway? You know, they had to have some reason for gathering the memories up, you know, beyond giving them away again. No, he was just going to have to avoid where that led. Burn him. The bloody foxes were inside his head right then. They had to be. It's the only explanation that made sense. And it's just one of those weird things that, you know, you kind of wonder, you know. We sort of assume that the snakes feed on the sensations that they experience while viewing people. And the foxes seem to have this connection to people's memories, particularly their dying memories. And you do kind of wonder, you know, do they... Is this like some weird sort of food for them, or, you know, why do the Finns collect these memories?
Oh, my own personal theory has always been that they get incredibly bored sitting in their high-chambered rooms in this weird palace, whatever things that they exist in, and so they collect these memories for entertainment, kind of like we have TV shows and movies and what have you. And that's their form of entertainment. We get when we watch these, because we don't have our own lives to lead. We have to sit in these stupid palaces or whatever. So we'll watch other people's lives, because, yeah. Warm up the flat screen. Let's watch that one guy who died a couple hundred years ago, just for fun.
Well, that makes so much a different view on my video collection now. I also kind of liked the meeting with the Tinkers. Just because, you know, both sets of people immediately... Tuan and Seleucia, of course, go off and speak with the ladies, and Matt speaks with the seeker. And, you know, each one seems to, you know, set on resolving the issue of having startled the Tinkers or having concerned them in their own ways. And, it was kind of nice because, you know, you got Matt and this older gentleman just kind of like, well, you know how things are. And he's like, yeah, I know how things are. And we don't really ever get to know what it was that Tuan says that gets all of the ladies laughing. But, you know, it's obviously, you know, something along the lines of women's circle business, I imagine. You know, things that they fear that we menfolk wouldn't understand.
Mayhaps we should put some pressure on Brandon and Tor, see if we can't get them to figure it out and add it into the next book. There's nothing I like less than an unsolved mystery.
True. Of course, though, because it was mentioned, and, you know, we're very fond on the podcast of saying that Mr. Jordan did not put anything into the series that he makes special note of without it coming back later. I could see... You know, Matt getting kind of a bird is side about it, and maybe not necessarily in the next book, because we don't even know if Matt and Tuan are reunited, you know, prior to the last, you know, novel. But I could see them being around each other just long enough for him to go, you know what, I can't stand it anymore. What did you say to them? And you know, it just being one of those little... sort of lighthearted and comedic moments where if Tuan is in the proper mood, she might actually break down and give him a straightforward answer. Well, of course, one of the most significant things in the chapter is, of course, the revolution of what Aludra wants to do with her work as, or her experience as an illuminator, in the crafting of the dragons and the dragon's eggs. I, of course, am amongst many, many others who the instant she said, you know, tell me why I would need a Bellfounder and I'll share all my secrets with you, you know, that we're like, oh, look, she's making a canon. If to me it seemed amazingly obvious right off the bat. Now, that's partially because I've studied a good chunk of medieval and, you know, other sorts of Renaissance inventions, including the development of black powder weapons. And it's interesting in several cultures in our own society, the art of warfare changes dramatically when black powder weapons, the pistol, the musket, and particularly the cannon are finally introduced, because the lethal force that any black powder weapons provide just fundamentally reshapes how people go to war.
Well, yeah, they suddenly have an increased range, and even with that increased range, an increased capacity for dealing damage. But, yeah, I wasn't among those few that you're talking about. It took me until he was talking to her, "You want to make lofting tubes for this?" Like, oh, well, that's interesting. Yeah, that does make sense. But I think it's really cool how she has thought through this entirely, even to the point where she knows how many horses it will take to pull one of these on a cart. She's not just saying, oh, I want to make a big cannon to throw things at the enemy and blow them to bits. She's actually thinking of their military application and how you can actually use them in battle.
Yeah, definitely. And that shows some very forward momentum and very astute understanding of the practical application. I mean, part of this comes from, she mentions herself, you know, the guild has been my life ever since I was a girl. And she was practically raised around, you know, the secrets of creating the fireworks. And, you know, as we saw, you know, with Matt, I mean, he stuffed a whole bunch of fireworks into the Stone of Tyr and that, and blew a hole in the side of it. I mean, it's one of those things that you don't work around explosive materials without being able to think of it. But it is very nice to see that she has this kind of analytical mindset that allows her to press forward and see the applicability of her modifications on the pre-existing designs.
You know, something interesting that just occurred to me. I've always kind of wondered why the guild doesn't let everyone doesn't just let anyone know about the secrets of the fireworks and how they work, and even to the point of spreading disinformation. The idea that if you cut one open, it'll explode, because they don't want you to know how these are made. They don't want you to know about it. And that always kind of confused me, but I was just thinking of it. And it's exactly for this. It's exactly because of the military applications and these things. They don't want to see them used as weapons. Or they didn't. The guild is now Aldra, and she does. But they didn't want to see them used as weapons, because they were beautiful things made for lighting up the sky and pleasing the eye. But it's almost positive that they knew what the applications could be if it was turned the wrong way. And so it kind of makes me wonder if maybe she, obviously she came up with a lot of this herself, but it kind of makes me wonder what other foundations were laid in the guild before she even was kicked out that caused it to happen.
Yeah, I mean, there are definite ties to the ancient Chinese culture, in which, you know, they were famous, very famous for their fireworks. But amidst that, they also had, and I found it interesting that she would call them dragons, because in a number of depictions that you would see would be something like a lofting tube, I'm assuming made of bamboo in this particular case. I might be terribly wrong about that. With, you know, a sort of like dragonish shaped head on it, and you would light the wick in the end after placing it in the ground, and essentially the tube would explode, but your charge would still carry forward. And it was one of the first cannon-like creations that, or amidst the first, that has actually been seen in historical records. So, I mean, it's just one of those things that Aludra seems to really bring forward, that sort of, you know, they had learned how to use, or how to create the powder necessary to create the fireworks, and they saw a military application, and of course they had no problem with using it as a military application as well.
Tulon recounts, as has been recounted many times, how the prophecies in Shandar talk about how the Dragon Reborn is going to have to kneel before the Crystal Throne. And I know that most of the time I've thought that that's just showing kind of the power of the Shadow in Shandar or what have you, that they can alter the prophecies of the dragon. But I was thinking about it, especially as I was listening to the last podcast where you're talking about how the prophecies mention Perrin, but we have never heard that before. We've never heard that line when the Wolf King carries the hammer or the Fox marries the Raven. We've never heard that before. It makes me wonder if it's not that the prophecies have been changed, it's that just that over in Shandar, especially where we can see that the foretelling talent is so strong, they've been added to.
So your thought then is that because there is a stronger prevalence for foretelling in Shandar, that they have continued to update and modify the prophecies, as opposed to just the twisting of them that was implemented by Ishamael during one of his lapses from the boar.
Yeah, but it almost makes sense, except it doesn't, because they kind of assume that everyone on this side of the ocean will know the same prophecies that they do. But we do know, Tuan talks about, you know that the Damani can tell fortunes. We haven't seen that be a common talent here on this side of the ocean. But apparently it's enough over there that they believe that all the Damani, or at least the majority of the Damani, can tell fortunes. So it seems to me like there's no reason why the prophecy shouldn't have been added onto. I'm not sure if this is one of those cases or if this is a twisting. But the biggest argument against is that they expect that the people over here have the same prophecies, that they have the same version of the dragon prophecies, and we don't.
True. I mean, I definitely think they would have it in there. I'm interested in that idea that we know Rand, at the very least, has studied the prophecies. I mean, he's read every translation he could possibly find. We also know that certain scholarly Aes Sedai took a great interest in Mat and in Perrin. Particularly, I'm now thinking of Varin having that interest in Perrin and, what's her name? Alana. Also having great interest in Perrin once he returned to the Two Rivers, following his eyes changing color and, you know, the more stronger connection that he shows, you know, about when he returns to the Two Rivers. I'm not wondering now if there are some, because isn't Varin one of the people who asks him about whether or not he's made the choice between the hammer and the axe at some point?
And yeah, now that I'm thinking about it, yeah, there was a point in time when Varin was handling Perrin's axe and asked, when are you going to give this up for the hammer? And he's completely shocked by it.
Which means, I mean, that's kind of an indication that maybe, you know, like, we just because we haven't heard from it from Rand, that, you know, maybe these are parts of our prophecies, and the people of Randland just, you know, haven't had a, you know, set published Bible-esque version of the prophecy, or the Corinthian cycle printed at any point in time. Of course, most printed books are difficult to come by in this particular culture, it seems.
It is far more likely that Ishmael twisted the prophecies, especially concerning the Crystal Throne, because there really isn't any conceivable reason for Rand to kneel before the Crystal Throne. Well, unless it's literally just him kneeling down and then getting up again and starting talking, but the common translation is obeisance to the throne. He's going to swear loyalty or whatever, is an actual kneeling to the throne rather than the literal folding your legs under your person. I don't know. It was just a random thought.
True. I mean, and that also, of course, brings up, you know, the competing prophecies where, wherein on this side of the ocean it says, you know, the daughter of the nine moons must be bound to the dragon reborn. And, you know, there's a small contingent of people who have not wondered. You know, Rand has three or four women who have bonded him, and we know that the Ashaman are capable of binding warders. You know, would it be possible for Rand in one of those moments to do, you know, the sheer unthinkable and bind Matt's wife to him?
I don't think Matt would let him get away with it. But, you know, there is the possibility that Elaine has this weird, interesting thing she's come up with that allows non-channelers to be bound together or what have you. I don't know. Maybe something can come between Tuon and Matt, but I doubt it.
Well, I don't know. I think doing so, as much as it would be a literal twist, I don't think Matt and Perrin and Rand need any more connections between them. The swirling color patterns becoming images of what the other person is doing at that exact moment is quite enough.
Yeah, especially when you catch them in a moment that you really don't want to.
Which seems to happen with alarming frequency. Chapter 9, entitled A Short Path, continues Matt's point of view. After they return from their ride, Matt rides alongside Aegyanin and Doman. Even Miura and her lepers are boring to Matt now. Aegyanin tells him Aegon was a perfect courting gift. Later, he talks her into telling him about the Shanshan royalty. They are taught intrigue and fighting from birth. Tuon has had at least a sister and a brother assassinated, and if I remember correctly, some sold into servitude in order to gain her place as the favored and heir to the throne. The empress in the Shanshan world always has several children in order to assure that the most fit successor will ascend to the throne, and thereby instills competition amongst them to kind of fuel their fighting and develop their skills so that only the most fit can become the next emperor or empress. Teslin, Edesina, and Jolene have become careless when visiting villages. Bethemon and Seda no longer report on their actions to Matt. Bethemon is training, and Satel is sure that Seda can also see weeds. The Aes Sedai found the same loophole in Matt's fox head as Adelise and Van Deen had once done. Jolene often pelts him with rocks, but only when Blaric and Fenn are with her. When they are alone, Satel asks to see the fox head again, and Matt lets her hold it. He guesses, as has been alluded to several times, that she was once Aes Sedai, and she admits that this is the case. Jasper, her husband, found her in the streets of Abu Dhar after she was severed, and took her home to his mother. She agrees to keep Matt's secret, that being that he is absolutely in love with Tuon. Luca lets it slip to the Aes Sedai that Tuon is a high lady, and they begin badgering her to try to negotiate a truce with the Shanshan. One evening, Lopin and Nerim prepare supper for Matt, Tuon, Seleucia, Nol, and Olver. After Olver leaves, Nol tells stories about the Seven Towers of Malkier and Shol Arbella, the City of 10,000 Bells, and Arafel. Jolene, Teslin, and Edesina enter and demand that Tuon end the war before Tarmon Gaiden. Seleucia, the ever-dutiful bodyguard, slips Nadam onto Teslin, and in the confusion puts one on Jolene as well. Tuon has both bracelets. Edesina tries to run, but Tuon binds her with air and slams the door on Blaric and Fenn. Tuon demonstrates the Adam on Jolene. Matt tries to talk her into letting them go, but she refuses. He moves toward them, and the fox head grows cold. one, like everyone who encounters Matt's fox head for the first time is shocked that the weaves don't work. Matt releases Teslin, then makes all three to stop, or makes all three Aes Sedai agree to stop badgering Tuan. Then he releases Jolene. Matt buries the three Adam in a deep hole and gets soaked in the rain for his trouble. The last set of dice are still, at this point, tumbling in his head. One of the interesting things, and I really liked this, is when Matt comes around to the revelation that Satel was Aes Sedai. Evidence seems to suggest, and this is substantiated by Encyclopedia Watt, that she is, or she was at one point, Martine Janata. Around 935 New Era, shortly after being raised to Aes Sedai, she begins studying Tarangriel. In 975, after 40 years worth of study, she is accidentally stilled by an unknown Tarangriel and disappears from the White Tower. We assume from there that she made her way to Abu Dhar, and while dying, is found by Jasper Anon, and nurses her back to health and gives her a new purpose in life, thereby staving off the deadly effects of having been severed.
It's always interesting to me when I read these theories, is the ability of the fans of Wheel of Time to make these connections. Like, honestly, I couldn't remember having heard of Martine Janata until after I started looking into the fan sites and all that, and like, oh, Satala Nana's who? How come I've never heard that name before? But the ability of you, the listeners to the podcast, the fans of Robert Jordan and the Wheel of Time, to make the connections between these people and these obscure little things, it's absolutely amazing to me. So props to you guys.
Yeah, it was definite, because the passages that mention Martine are really very short. They are in a single chapter in which Varen gives Egwene the twisted ring Tarangriel that allows access to Teleronriad, and she makes mention very horribly briefly about, you know, how Martine had studied all of these Tarangriel and then just one day accidentally stilled and no one knows what happened to her. So it was one of those kind of things when someone shows up who, with increasing evidence, at one point was Aes Sedai and is no longer. It kind of seemed to be like one of those nice snap togethers. And I will admit, I had forgotten up until almost reading Knife of Dreams that about that particular story, and it just, in one of my rereads recently, I had gone back through and been like, oh, that's where that story came from. There is another note made, and this one I definitely want to credit to Encyclopedia Watt as well, that Tuan being shocked when the weaves don't affect Matt implies that Tuan is actually capable of seeing the weaves. And we do know that Tuan is a very adept Sildam, and that a number of Sildam do actually say that they, you know, they have used the One Power so much that they almost can see the waves, and of course I think that's hedging the truth a little bit. Tuan, of course, being part of the Imperial family, probably has been instructed in the Shanshan's dread secret, which is how she is so lighthearted about the fact that she has the potential to be able to channel in her, and, you know, how she is able to brush it off, saying, well, I choose not to. It is not something I do, and therefore I am not like them.
Yeah, and I think that's really, there are a lot of times when I couldn't understand And I think there are a lot of people who really don't understand the Shanshan's abject fear of women who can channel, and or hatred or their treatment. But this is one of the probably the best example of why they feel the way they do. It's to them, it's akin to murder or thievery. It's practically evil. The ability to channel is evil, but if it's collared and used the right way for the service of the empire or the imperial family or what have you, then it's not as evil, but the Mani still need to be kept a tight leash on them. And it's... with the way that we know things were in Shandar when they came over, it's kind of understandable. The Aes Sedai there, for some reason, didn't have the structure that those on Randland did. They went crazy and got into power struggles, and they were evil for all intents and purposes. But really, it's kind of hard to visualize, especially where we've had the Aes Sedai, the Aiel Wise Ones, the Windfinders of the Othanmir. We've seen all these who we know them to be good people at heart. We know that the ability to channel is not what makes one evil, but the feeling and that fear and hatred is so bred into the Shanshan Empire that that we have Damani. It's scary, sort of. Never underestimate the power of hatred.
It also is just a testament to what Randland could have been like if the Three Oaths hadn't been instituted in the first place.
I disagree, because I think the Three Oaths came around much later than, if I remember correctly, they came around during the, I think it was during the reign of Hawkwing, or shortly thereafter, or during the Trolloc Wars, I don't recall which, but Randland had been existing with Aes Sedai for several centuries prior to that, and I don't know what the difference was. I know the oaths were instituted to restore the faith in Aes Sedai so that they could get their little puppet strings onto everyone, but I don't think that the differences can be attributed to the Three Oaths, but that's my own personal opinion.
Well, not entirely to the Three Oaths. We know that there was a drastic difference in just the general culture. In the Shanshan Empire, there wasn't the drive to follow the pattern. Obviously, the White Tower is loosely based off of the society of Aes Sedai from the Age of Legends. There is a ruling structure and a some sort of hierarchical class. And I think those in Randland just kind of readily adopted that because it was familiar, whereas the channelers in Shanshan saw that opportunity that they were no longer bound within that particular culture. And as a result, decided, well, you know, we have the most power, therefore we should be the ones in charge. And it's just that weird difference. I don't know what makes them different. And it would be interesting to see at some point. But I do not know if we will ever get a view of why they developed as differently as they did.
And it's kind of interesting because we know, it's been said that in Shandar, the Steading aren't as limited as they are in Randland, and so the Ogier gardeners, the Ogier there, never got the longing. So they don't have to return to a steading every once in a while or start waning in health or whatever it is. But it seems to me that if the steading are more prevalent there, then channelers would be less powerful there. But I could be reading too much into it.
I was misremembering. For some reason, I had thought that the ruling was that there weren't steading, and the Ogier just kind of went, okay, fine, there's no steading, we don't care. And they just kind of got past it. But no, I have to think that that's not right. I don't know where I'm thinking of that from.
Well, I'm going to take this opportunity to introduce one of my own pet theories, which is based on the theory that there are friends of the light. From her actions in this chapter and the others, to me, it seems like Teslin is a good candidate for one of the light friends, or whatever you want to call them. Because here in this chapter, this is just one of the scenes of many that make me think that she's capable of focusing on something other than herself and her own plans, with the exception of wanting to kill the Soldam. But even before she was Damani, she unnecessarily went out of her way to give advice to Elaine and Nynaeve. Here, the specific scene I'm talking about is the one where she gets after Jolene for practically abusing Matt. And we know that none of the other the sisters that came with him out of Saladar, none of them felt the same way. Of course, he didn't get any of them out of a leash, but still. Really, I think she's the only Red that we've met so far that I actually like. But that might just be because she's been out of the tower for a while and not under Elida's influence. But I think it would be interesting if she ended up joining the Rebel Aes Sedai. I think because of just the fact that she's the only Red with the Rebels would mean that she would be the Red Sitter. It could get interesting, but I don't know. I'm not sure if she's a likable enough character for that, but...
Well, yeah, but I mean, on top of that, if you've got your secret society of dark friend channelers and your secret society of, as Virginia often said, light friend channelers, you know, not all of them have to be likable. I mean, I know a number of people who assume Varen to be black, a number of people who assume her to be the opposite of black, and, amidst that group, there are people who absolutely love her and people who just can't stand her and are just waiting for her to show her quote-unquote true colors.
Her true colors? Plaid. No, but I guess, really, especially in fantasy like this, most of the time you come with the notion, I'm reading fantasy, there's going to be a side that I'm supposed to like and a side that I'm supposed to dislike. But it's really not that way. Especially, and thinking specifically about the split of the tower, there are people in Saladar who are written such that you will not like this character, and there are people who are in the tower that are written such that you will, even though you're supposed to be rooting for the rebels, because that's where the Wonder Girl all hang out, and, you know, you're meant to hate Elida, because she's very hateable. Still, it's interesting to me to be able to go on to both sides of the issue and say, okay, I like that person over there, I like that person over there, I like that person over there. But on this side of the aisle, I like this person, and this person. But I'm still going to go with one side or the other overall. I may like this character, but that doesn't stop them from being wrong.
Yeah, definitely very true. I kind of liked... You know, this is just a side and aesthetic note. I kind of liked... the image wherein the two Aes Sedai were collared, and you know, here sits Tuan perfectly calmly yet horribly regal with, you know, an Aes Sedai bound to each wrist, and you know, in that moment I kind of had a vision of what Empress Radahan must have looked like sitting on the crystal throne. I just have to, you know, just have this image of this, you know, this dark woman, you know, with the, you know, a bracelet on each arm, you know, bound to Aes Sedai, and just the concept that she's able to control, you know, because at this point we didn't really even know if it was possible to control more than one woman at a time if you were wearing more than one bracelet, and it just, it seems like it was just a really imperial image that I got, you know, from Tuan, and I thought that was superbly neat.
I really like all these little moments that knock Jolene down a couple notches on her own, I'm an Aes Sedai, I'm better than the world, or whatever scale, but she never learns from any of them. It's really upsetting at times. I mean, I'm trying to think of some of the other characters that are as bad as she is, and the only one that comes to mind is Elida.
Yeah, there is that that's similar. Because I am Aes Sedai, this is how I can be, and, you know, yeah, that sheer unwillingness, almost, to learn, it is just more than a bit disturbing.
It's like they never mature. They're beat down as novices, they're beat down as accepted, and then they become Aes Sedai, and suddenly they're perfect, they're the epitome of what they all should be, and so they stop learning, they stop growing, they stop maturing. I mean, I gotta be perfectly honest. Teslin's adamance that the Soldan be left to die just reminds me of a whiny teenager. It seems like something that Egwene should be doing, and Egwene is not even into her 20s yet. Or if she is, she's in her early 20s. Teslin's been alive a whole lot longer. She should have a better worldview. She should be more mature, but she's not.
True, and it's also just that idea that, oh, we figured out that Tuan is a high lady, therefore we have to barge in there, and we have to, you know, enforce a way to negotiate a peace treaty, and we have to, you know, and it's just kind of that idea of, well, maybe if you took a moment to think about who you're dealing with first, you might learn something about, you know, a best way to approach someone with, you know, a way to try to talk out your arguments. I don't know.
And it's a red, a green, and a yellow do not a gray make.
Well, it looks like our discussion of these particular chapters involving Matt are running just a bit long. So what we are going to do is divide this podcast into two separate podcasts and continue our discussion of this section of Matt chapters as we continue our Knife of Dreams recap in another episode. So, for myself, Andrew Gellos, and everyone here at the Fourth Age, Sarabyanintu Manshima, Tai Shite.
Incidentally, and once again outside of the podcast, the more and more I think about casting The Eye of the World as a movie, and it would just be sad because if they continued the rest of the series as a TV series, it could never happen. I would actually probably at this point give the role of Tom to, if he would take it, Christopher Lee. I really think that he could pull off the voice and the sheer power that Tom seems to emit at times. It seems really nice, and, you know, he already has the ability to have, like, long, you know, the white hair and the bushy, you know, kind of mustaches. I think he could pull off pretty easily. And that, and I've heard him say, you know, the famous phrase, Ashnaz Dematuluk, Ashnaz Gimbatul, Ashnaz Kthrakhtluk, Agberzhrim, Ishik Rimpatul. It's a wonderful phrase.
See, I gotta be honest, I can't think of him as anything but a villain, just because my experience with his acting abilities has been those popular shows where he's been the villain. He is a great actor. I've kind of given up trying to assign actors to certain roles. I have a list of actors that I think would be great in the movie, and maybe some ideas of where they could fit in, but that's a good actor, that's a good actor, that's a good actor, that's a good actor, and that's a good actor, and that's good. Oh, that actor could play that part, that's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I moreover would like to see no-name people cast, really, just because if they were then to try to continue outside of the movie format, it would be easier not to have to replace a bunch of big-name stars when you then transfer into a serial television series. Now, it's just my assumption that that would be the best way for it to play out. But
yeah, I can't see something as big as The Wheel of Time working as a movie series at all. I mean, look at what's happened with Harry Potter, and it's only 7 books. And I know I'm tired of them already. But even a television series, I think it would take too long, because it would take several years to get out everything that's in the books. All this wonderful stuff that's in the books, it would take several years to put out. And it's supposed to happen in the space of 2. Your actors would get way too old, way too quick.
True. I mean, in that case, you'd have to take some amount of artistic license. I mean, unless you did it as an animated series, in which case, then you only need people to voice the characters.
No, please, no animated. Although, I have to admit, I am a big fan of motion capture, despite the horrible job they did with Beowulf. I think that it is one of the best ways to do movies anymore. The best way to shoot. It's not really live action, but it's pretty darn close.
It's an interesting thing. Like I said, there's a number of ways I could see them doing things. And I could deal with an animated series if it were done properly. And the problem is there are so few people or so few companies capable or willing to do it properly anymore, that, you know, the hope of ever seeing it would just vanish into a quantum singularity.
I gotta be perfectly honest, I did not enjoy anime-type artistic renderings. I'd like to go and look at the gallery on Dragon out of all the fan art, but all the stuff that's so based on anime-type drawings, I don't like it. But I do prefer the kind of anime-type magic and fight scenes with the big, flashy knock you halfway around the world with a single sphere of energy. That's always fun.
Yeah, I mean, there are a few that I really like, and there are some ways that could be nice. I think it would fall very too easily if you tried just a single anime style or a single traditional animation, or even, heaven forbid, the CGI 3D animation series, which can fail so miserably, so easily.
Yeah, that's really what happened on Beowulf, is they didn't have good, well, first of all, they only had mediocre actors, a crappy script, and then the animation wasn't done very well, but that's the thing with motion capture, is you just have to find the right voice, you don't have to find the right face, but you still have to create the character properly in the computer to react on the skeleton. But anyway.
True. Grendel, woo!